Thanks. So it's a pleasure to be at KITP. I see the throes of construction. I hope next time I come, it'll all be a beautiful, shining building again. So let me first mention my collaborator, Sujay Ashok, a student at Rutgers, Frederick Deneff and Bogdan Floria, postdocs, and Bernie Schiffman and Steve Zeldich are mathematicians at Johns Hopkins. So I'm going to give a relatively non-technical talk. I think I'm going to want a pointer. I see it. And it can easily be a very technical subject, but I'm happy to speak about that at length, today, tomorrow, afterwards. So to give a little bit of introduction, this introduction can expand to most of the talk, but I'll save you that. There's this point of view which I think sort of crystallized February, March 2003, so a little more than a year ago. Various people at Stanford, myself, partly inspired by a work of Joe and Raphael Bousseau, partly in my case inspired just by the incredible complication of doing anything in the compactification of string theory that might make contact with the real world, and the desperate search for any kind of simple question that you might be able to actually answer to give some sort of organizing principle to it. And so this is the sort of thing which I came up with, thinking in those directions. And anyhow, there is this point of view which basically says that it seems very clear from 20 years of research that there are very, very many vacua of string and M theory, certainly at the level to which we can do the analysis and justify and think, yeah, these ones look kind of sensible. There are many, many vacua. There are all the choices of Calabi-Yau and bundle or brains, and more recently, the focus on choices of flux and on the particular phase, the particular minimum of the effective potential seem to show that these numbers are drastically huge and that there's not an obvious thing, mechanism in the theory that's going to reduce that number. Now, it looks like you can actually understand some of the vacua even in, well, it's not done yet, it's the sort of thing we'll talk about, 10-dimensional superstring theory, but in particular, 4-dimensional effective field theory. You can think in terms of effective potential depending on the light fields, stabilizing those light fields. That's a controversial point for some, never proven, but it sure looks like it. That's part of this point of view. So you can, by studying all these string compactifications in principle, find some distribution, some set of effective field theories that comes out, and of course the distribution of the vacua, critical points, minima of the effective potential within this distribution. And then this is supposed to be a mathematically well-defined thing in principle. We certainly don't know how to formulate string theory precisely enough to do that, but if string theory has a precise definition, someday we'll be able to do that. So there is just this problem out there as a problem in math. Find all these effective field theories. Of course, you could try to find vacua also that are not described by effective field theory. At the moment, those seem less interesting to describe our universe, but they're there too. Anyhow, find, to cut the problem down a bit, the effective field theories and start talking about the statistics of this distribution and interesting quantities, of which I'll talk about. And so why would you do this? Well, there's at least two good reasons. One is that there seem to be so many models that you could imagine solving classic problems of physics this way. For example, the cosmological constant problem, as Joe and Raphael pointed out. Even problems of explaining the spectrum, explaining the hierarchy, and so forth, can take on a different light when you think of them in the context of a very large number of models. And you can debate whether you like this solution or whether it is a solution, if you just find a model that reproduces something without explaining, quote, why. But if they're there, you should know it. Certainly as a string theorist, you should know it. And then to add to that, we don't really know any principles that prefer or pick out specific vacua. There probably are such principles, and this is a very interesting thing to work on, but what I kind of doubt, and what certainly is part of this point of view here, is that there's an a priori principle which just from the start tells you have to use Calabi-Yau, F227, and turn on these fluxes and so forth. It's just not the way physics works, that you're going to get that information from the start. Rather, the selection principles are going to be things that require a great deal of work to check in any example, and so you're going to have to ask more questions more like, what fraction of this huge number of vacua pass my selection principle? And to the extent that you have to do that, you also are forced into this type of mold. Okay, so that's a point of view which suggests certain questions, and this is the type of question that I've been working on. So a very primary question, of course, is how many vacua are there? And in some sense, how are they distributed? How are these effective field theories distributed in theory space? Now, of course, to work on a problem, it has to be something concrete. And so we can say how many weakly coupled type 2B compactifications on Calabi-Yau. We could say something else. We can try to rise above that level and someday talk about all. But let's talk about what we can do. Okay, well, vacua basically means you calculate this effective potential, you look for isolated minima that have stabilized all the light fields, and they should be minima, so they should be tachyon-free. And ideally, you would impose that they live longer than a second or something, or even cosmologically, but at least metastable. Okay, so that's a question you can work on along the standard lines that I'll discuss of effective field theory. You always worry that you're missing things, and there are further consistency conditions in string theory that you didn't take into account in that analysis, even within the context of effective field theory, as I'll come to a bit, but I have no results in this direction. It could be that you made a mistake in dropping certain fields, which in some sort of supersymmetric limit were clearly massive, or you could neglect them, and then you've continued to some region of interest, say where you broke supersymmetry, and then they turn out to be tachyonic, but you didn't see it because you dropped them too early on in the analysis. So that's
So what would be an example of this? Say if you had a massive string mode, you're just right. That somehow you could.
It could be that there are, although you had delicate cancellations producing small energies in the effective field theory, it could be a result of string scale energies canceling in 10 dimensions, which allow you to drop a massive string state to become tachyonic. And it could be that an effective field theory analysis could miss that. It's not something which we have clear examples of, but it's definitely a possibility to keep in mind. I myself at this point think this is the most likely way that the numbers that we're coming up with now could be drastic overestimates. But I don't have a concrete example of that.
I noticed you don't have any considerations.
Well, I will mention it at the third, but that's about it. We can discuss that afterwards too, because that again can deserve a talk of its own.
We expect that all these vacuum, even if they aren't tachyons, have tunneling instability.
That's right. That could have been a instability, that's right.
Is there going to be there? I mean, is that somehow...
Well, that's right. I mention a question of that sort later, and that's obviously an important question, too. I'm sort of... That has been analyzed in, as two, three, four papers, and so far people have not found... They tend to be things that have cosmological timescales.
Well, they're cosmological because something else is really small,
I certainly quite agree. This has to be analyzed. And another point in that regard is it could be that there's some huge number of targets. Each decay has a cosmological timescale, but there are 10 to the 1,000 targets, and that you're supposed to just add these decay rates. So these are there are various possibilities we haven't explored for instabilities that might cut down the number of actual candidate vacua. Okay, and then there are the more subtle sorts of things that Tom Banks and collaborators talk about. Okay, so granting some definition of vacua, which we can refine as time goes on, how are the broad features of these vacua distributed? Cosmological constant, supersymmetry, breaking scale, hierarchy perhaps defined as masses of scalars, perhaps if you construct a standard model within, defined in the standard way. Are there likely to be hidden sectors? What is the structure, the generic structure, or the distribution of structures of hidden sectors? So it's a very important result of the original heterotic pictures that, yes, you predicted a hidden sector. Now, if you sort of take the existing brain constructions in Calabi-Yau at face value, you sort of tend to think that they predict huge numbers of hidden sectors, but nobody's looked at that systematically. Maybe that's not true. So it'd be nice to know something about the distribution within this theory space of numbers of hidden sectors, how they're coupled to the visible sector.
You mean just from brains at other places?
Yeah, clearly. And
are you taking these distributions as probability?
No, definitely not. Okay, so that's part of the preface which I've given. I gave here in October, and many talks. Basically, all the distributions I talk about give each vacuum weight one. There's some delta function in theory space for each vacuum. It's normalized to the total number. We can then go on and decide what to do with it. But this is the thing which, given our present knowledge of string theory, seems clearly well defined. And if we decide that the region which fits the standard model has no such delta functions, that's obviously a very important result. We can stop at that point. Okay.
On this general line, what do you think the odds are that the number of such vacua is in fact infinite?
Well, I don't think so, but it's obviously an important question. Again, I discussed this at some length in other talks. We can discuss afterwards if you like. Okay. So, and then finally, obviously, questions of how couplings in the visible sector are distributed. But at our present stage of knowledge, this is kind of a late thing. There are all these other things that you wouldn't have talked about in more traditional analyses that were more bottom-up. And I think you can probably learn more about these things to start with, because we have so little information from other sources. Okay, so obviously you'd like to not just know distributions of individual features, but if there are really significant correlations between them, ultimately you'd like to know, you know, how many. See, the simplifying thing, there are many simplifying things about this, and one of them is that it could well be. It's in fact rather likely that some of these things are decorrelated, and to the extent that different aspects that have to go into the model that reproduces our world are decorrelated, it's far, clearly going to be far simpler to estimate the fraction that gets feature A right and feature B right, like three generations and the small cosmological constant. We have no reason at present to think they're correlated. It could be that they're decorrelated. By progressing along these lines, you could show, you know, to some sort of convincing, you know, level that they are decorrelated, and then you could work on those problems separately. So that's the simplifications that are possible in addressing what, you know, is a very, obviously, the prime question of string phenomenology, but I think you could go farther in this sort of approach. Okay, so slightly more formal questions here. So is it really true that you can continue, for example, weakly coupled 2B and the strong coupling and small volume? Do most of the vacua live in the interior or in the outskirts? You know, are the statistics of the effective field theories you get out, do they actually care? You know, a very simple hypothesis is that although maybe the theory of our world is in some sense a strong coupling, the statistics of the vacua that we care about could be the same in the strong coupling region as they are in the weak coupling region. You know, obviously, you leave out a few, you know, but many of the statistics could be the same. So you could learn a lot about the problem of real interest in the controlled regime. You know, again, hypothesis, but a you know, not a crazy hypothesis to work on. Okay, are the known ensembles, let's say we can grant that we can continue 2B and 2A and M3 on G2 and all these things into some sort of strongly coupled regime, should we believe that this covers a order one fraction of all the vacua or all the vacua? There's a separate question. So I use the word representative is a little bit, there's a precise meaning in statistics. Okay, so a set of vacua, an ensemble, to give it some, you know, fancier name, but the reason I emphasize this concept of ensemble is that we don't know any actual set of vacua. And all the work on this subject has to proceed by hypothesizing. Here is something I think is a set of vacua according to my present knowledge, and somebody else can come along and propose a better one. So we should keep clear that we are making these hypotheses when we work. And so that's why I try to formalize that in the idea of, you know, first you say this is the ensemble of vacua I'm working on. It doesn't, you know, it may not be the actual story of 2B, but at least it's a precise thing I say. And so the representative in this, you know, in statistics means that the statistics are the same in your sample as they are in the whole set. You know, so that's what we would really like from the statistical point of view. Of course, for counting, we would really like this. We'd like to have constructions to get an order one fraction of all the vacua. So they're both interesting questions. Okay, could it even be that you can get away with extrapolating a single string construction? We don't know. Okay. Are the vacua, how are they very roughly distributed in configuration space? And so a sort of physical question of this sort of, suppose we found a selection principle that said, I come out of inflation in this little region R, you know, for whatever, you know, God knows what reason, literally. Then what fraction, you know, how good is this? Does this really, if I now take the subsequent dynamics, I've come out of this small region exiting inflation, does it then, you know, overwhelmingly likely to drop into some small region of the total space and drastically cut down the number of possible vacua? Or could it wind up going anywhere? If the configuration space is high enough dimensional, then in fact you sort of think you could go anywhere. I mean, obviously the real story is probably in between these two statements, but can we make that type of consideration precise? Okay, so I think this is an essential question for any kind of cosmological selection principle that anybody might come up with. And it's something I think you can start to work with on the level I'm talking. Okay, and then finally, I agree, it may turn out that all this is usefully combined in the end with anthropic considerations. And I always de-emphasize it in my talks because I think there are these string theory questions which in principle are totally well-defined within string theory, and it's conceptually clearer to separate the questions. But indeed, in the whole story, this is also an important thing to think about. This is all, in this language, this is all establishing the prior. You know, there is some prior distribution that comes out of string theory, and we like to say things about it to the extent we can, independent of this actual world that we see.
But if, say, if one is using anthropic consideration, some of these others might not be so relevant. Like the one just above it, for example, it doesn't matter if you have a high likelihood or not.
Well, yeah, that's right. You can say that, and you can also say the opposite. So I think it's still an interesting question, and it might still be relevant.
So you can say the opposite.
Yeah, we can both say both things. These are all questions. You know, I'm not saying that any one of these things is the key question. I'm trying to throw out interesting questions that might have answers. Yeah.
Michael, you're talking about the fraction of order one fraction of vacua.
Right.
The number of vacua is infinite.
Then, that's right, then things start to become bad in general. I mean, it could be that if there's an infinite number of guys that don't look anything like us, we don't care. But once there start to be an infinite number of guys that have any chance of looking like us, the whole story starts to become very bad. Okay, so...
And it's not known about them.
That's right, it's certainly not at all proven that the number is finite. Even the number of Calabi-Yau's is not proven to be finite. Okay. Okay, so most of the talk, I'm going to talk about the questions of stabilizing moduli and just finding these critical points of an effective potential. And this, again, goes back a long way. And the basic outline is more or less unchanged for 20 years. People have been working on this problem for a while. The status of it is in heterodox string and type 2. As you can go to the supergravity limit, you know, GS alpha prime go to 0, you take the resulting 10 or 11 dimensional supergravity, compactify it on the appropriate manifold, do the Kaluza-Klein reduction, and then take some sort of nice, you know, fraction of the non-perturbative corrections that you can actually get your hand on and add those to the effective potential and see how far you can get. And ideally, you'll find minima where all the fields are massive and you break supersymmetry and so forth. And that's what we've still been doing. And people wrote papers about this 20 years ago. And it's been technical progress since, but quite significant technical progress. But of course, there still is no example in which even this part of the program was carried out to the end. Okay, so now people haven't in the last 10 years been putting the problem this way because we learned so much over the 1990s and everybody thought all the problems were different, and that could be. We learned a lot. Okay, we have various formal and conceptual and phenomenological progress. And on the other hand, it's still kind of consistent. Again, one way of looking at things is that this progress to some extent supports the point of view I started out with in the first slide, that you can understand a huge amount of that duality in terms of effective field theory with new light states and new corrections to the effective Lagrangian. Okay, so that's the reading of the situation that supports this point of view. You can also read many developments in other directions, but it seems not, you know, it seems to be still consistent with the point of view I talk about. Okay, so now where has progress come? Well, a fair amount of progress has come recently by considering flux vacua, which, again, spoken about, many people have spoken about at length. And flux is to turn on the p-form field strengths in the supergravity on internal cycles of the compactification manifold, in some way solving their equations of motion. So you typically get harmonic forms that way. And then the resulting vacuum energy depends on the metric moduli, can depend on other fields. You typically get an effective potential which has these isolated minima in terms of all the parameters that the flux energy depends on. And there's a nice formal setup which is based on what's called the Gukov-Watha-Witten superpotential, which I was at a talk by Gukov here on this, so I won't, again, go into great detail, but it's a very simple expression which is linear in the flux. You wedge it with whatever special form captures the whole, you know, the geometry appropriate to supersymmetry, such as the holomorphic 3 form on a Calabi-Yau. And then you have a Kähler potential, typically in large volume. There's just a natural Kähler potential on the moduli space of metrics, just the Bay-Peterson metric, basically. And then you can look for supersymmetric or non-supersymmetric vacuum of this superpotential. If you're looking for supersymmetric ones, almost all of them are supersymmetric ADS vacuum. And now at this point, we could get into more specifics, but this is the basic picture. Okay, so now a problem with using the flux superpotential is that in most compactifications, most classes, they don't depend on all the moduli. Okay, so you solve part but not all the problem, but there is a construction where they depend on all the moduli, and this is sort of the first one, you know, sort of semi-convincing way to get something to stabilize all the moduli, and this was developed by Bobby Acharya about the same time, January 03. If you compactify M theory on a manifold of G2 holonomy, then you don't have this distinction between Kähler and complex structure that you have in Calabi-Yau's. You just have metric moduli, which are the metric moduli themselves are all the periods of the preferred three form in G2 holonomy with in the supersymmetric theory complexified by adding the periods of the three form integrated over a basis of three cycles. Okay, so just all the metric moduli look like that. There's no dilaton. And so the basic idea I discussed, turning on four-form flux, gives you a superpotential Kähler potential depend on all these metric moduli.
Including the overall scaling of the
metric? Yeah.
And it has a minimum?
Okay, so now he analyzed that, and what you find is that, you see, the big problem is, of course, I'll say on the next slide, is that you can't compute this very much, but you can compute it in the one-parameter case, and it has a minimum for the actual metric moduli, but it doesn't control the real parts, the theta angles. Okay, and so you could try to go various ways, and what Acharya proposed is that there's a construction which he didn't spell out in detail, where you find a G2 manifold with a singularity of codimension 4, so you carry a gauge theory. It would become a D6 gauge theory if you go down to 2A. You turn on a Wilson line in that gauge theory, and you get a Turn-Simons term, which he argued would produce a constant shift to this W. And once you have this constant shift, it turns out that this generically stabilizes all these moduli. So if you grant that, then you can do it. Okay, and as I say, he didn't make this quite precise, but it's very plausible that there are things like this, okay, that are not that hard in this model. And so I think, in that sense, you should be able to solve the problem in this class of models. The main problem with them being that you can't compute anything. You don't have all this technology that people develop for the Calabi-Yau's for many, many, you know, good reasons. You know, the study of these, you know, complex manifolds is, you know, more than 100 years old, and people know a lot. Study of G2 manifolds is, you know, like 20 years, you know, 15 years old, and people know very little, and they have a lot of catching up to do. So if you want to compute things, you at present are better off working with complex geometry and Calabi-Yau's. There's even a conceptual, it's not just this historical fact. In a sentence, the reason that I like the 2B theory, and the 2B theory is much better, is that, you know, of course, one of the most basic simplifying properties of n equals 1 supersymmetry is the holomorphy. The superpotential is a holomorphic function, and you use that everywhere. So you want a framework that makes that holomorphy manifest. And in most of the constructions in M-theory on G2, in the 2A, the holomorphy is not manifest. You have to start adding instanton effects. If you work at tree order, you have exactly the phenomenon I described, that things don't depend on the, you know, say, real parts of the holomorphic variables. And now you have to work hard to get that dependence in. In the 2B, of course, the complex structure moduli already exhibit. All that depends on them typically exhibits that from the beginning. The brain fields, typically, you see holomorphy from the beginning. And you've not eliminated, as we'll discuss, but you've already gone very far on putting holomorphy into your problem. And so there's a great advantage from the start. So anyhow, you can write down the flux superpotential into 2B, and then it's known how to calculate the periods of the three form that appear here. And it's, you know, long mathematical papers. It's good that it's already been worked out in examples, because you wouldn't want to have to do it yourself. But it is known how to do it. Okay, so that covers the Kähler moduli and the dilaton, and it does not cover the complex structure and the dilaton. Does not cover the Kähler moduli. You can try dualizing, but then you still suspect that you'll leave out the dual of the Kähler moduli, and then this is generally less understood, these other dual possibilities. So it seems like the way to go at present is to take this as a very good starting point and then just go back adding in a few more non-perturbative corrections to stabilize the Kähler moduli. And this is the approach that Kähler et al. Suggested to follow. Okay, so do we expect this to happen? Well, yes, because all these gauge theories on world volumes their gauge couplings depend on Kähler moduli. So the basic example is type 1 theory, D9 brains, dual to heterotic. The gauge coupling depends, four-dimensional gauge coupling depends on the volume of the Calabi-Yau, Kähler modulus. So you know you're going to get non-perturbative corrections depending on that. So, you know, that the idea is reasonable from the start. Now, you can't construct such a nice class of flux vacuum in this case, and rather you work with O3 and O7 planes, and I guess Joe or his collaborators would have to explain, Steve as well, why they were led to this choice, but my understanding is that to turn on interesting sets of fluxes and stabilize the dilaton, you have to cancel this tadpole, this D3 tadpole, and so you need some O3 planes in the game, and then you're kind of forced into this framework, which is a nice framework because it's a limit of F3, which is one of the most general, probably the most general tractable framework for string compactification. And then the same type of general argument holds, so that's good. And indeed, you would get D7's wrapping cycles. You would expect to get non-perturbative effects exponentially small in the volume of these cycles. If you could find for each Kähler class, each Kähler modulus, a separate term of this sort or a separate gauge theory factor, you might think that you could often do it. Okay, well, that's not necessarily easy because not all supersymmetric gauge theories lead to superpotentials. And the basic constraint is if you have too much matter, in particular for the, you know, the standard case of super Yang-Mills with fundamental matter, you need NF less than NC. If NF is NC or greater, you don't generate this non-perturbative superpotential. You can do other interesting things, but you don't do that. And then you start looking at brain constructions, and typically they have a lot of matter. And so you can, for example, look through the work of Johannes here and collaborators, very detailed examination of brain or NFL configurations that come out of Geffner models at Quintic, you know, another Calabi-Yau, and you don't find anything. You know, just all the brain theories have lots of matter. Even one adjoint kills you by this consideration. So you need to look for theories that don't have even adjoint matter. And mathematically, that's just because almost all the cycles and almost all the bundles that you could put on the higher dimensional cycles have moduli, and every modulus leads to an adjoint field, and then you're already screwed. Okay, so now, how do you deal with this problem? Okay, well, one way is just to find those non-generic cases where there are just this, you know, limited number, B11, of different gauge theory sectors leading to these non-perturbative contributions. Okay, it's you need a systematic way to find them. They're not the things that you would think to look for first. Okay, now it could be that just despite what looks like moduli at an early stage analysis, they get lifted by a brain world volume superpotential. And the simplest way that can happen is if you put more or less any superpotential for this single adjoint matter, you'll typically get a non-perturbative superpotential. And on the other hand, this, besides taking more work, you know, than this geometry, is harder than you would think at first, because the way that this can also show up is that you start varying the moduli, and you typically induce lower order terms in the superpotential at this point. It's a sort of genericity argument, but it's borne out, you know, by looking at examples. And then you turn it into something with massive matter, and you're back up in this discussion. So doing a good job over here catches many of these. So in that sense, this is perhaps the better approach. It's obviously more subtle than what I've just said, but there's some truth to what I'm saying. Okay, so now another possibility is that turning on the fluxes, which we wanted anyways, will mass up some of this matter. And it's sort of clear at a basic level that this can happen. So if you look at the world volume action on the D7, it's got this explicit dependence on the B field. And now flux means that the B field has this interesting variation depending on position in the internal space. So isn't this going to give a potential which gets minimized for a specific embedding of the D7 brain and not for other embeddings? And then this will lift some of these moduli. So this is a good idea. It's one which hasn't been worked out in great detail, but certainly deserves to be pursued. And the main subtlety, you see, at this level, it's very clear what will happen, but then you need to check that you can do it with fluxes that don't also break the gauge symmetry. So you have to avoid turning on Fs that are in off-diagonal components, because those will break the gauge symmetry and put you right back where you started. So you need some level of detailed analysis to argue that this is going to work. Worth doing, but not yet done. Okay, so we'd like in any either of these approaches to find a systematic way. Okay, so now there is a systematic way for the first, okay, which was developed around 1997 when F-theory was a hot topic. And it comes out of a paper of Witten on non-perturbative effects in M-theory and F-theory, and in particular Donaghy and Grassi. Mathematicians developed the mathematics of this. Okay, so the F theory, the 2B we talked about is a Orient-Anifold limit of F theory, which you define in terms of a fourfold. And the sort of simplest physical way to define that is to start with M theory on a fourfold, which is elliptically fibered, has a T2 fibration over some three-dimensional base. And then there's a duality explained by Asimov and Schwarz. That, you know, one way of formulating M theory 2B duality is to take the volume of the T2 to zero and you recover 2B theory, and the complex modulus of the T2 becomes a dilaton axion. So you're constructing something with dilaton axion varying over the base, and that must be F theory. Okay, so that duality is a good way to think of the definition of F theory. Now, this relates the non-perturbative effects in F theory to those in M theory, and in M theory, you get contributions to the superpotential for M5 brains wrapped on hypersurfaces in this fourfold, which for mathematical reasons you almost always call divisors, but you can just think of hypersurfaces. Okay, and so there's a condition which Witten derived physically, which is necessary to produce a contribution to the superpotential from a single M5 brain instanton, which is that the divisor has to have arithmetic genus 1, and I'll say a little bit more about what this means. But physically, these count fermion zero modes, and this one is guaranteed. Each of these give you a spinner worth in three dimensions, so two fermion zero modes, and you just want two for a superpotential term. So this one has already given you what you need. And then the obvious way, the easiest way to make things work otherwise is just to have no more zero modes, all these zero. But there's a possibility that world volume couplings on the instanton can lift these in pairs, and so you get this type of necessary condition involving alternating signs, controlling the parity of the spinners on the world volume. So that's where this condition comes from. Okay, so that's the M theory discussion, and then when you bring it down to F theory, you've got an elliptically fibered T2 and you're sending it to zero size, and the divisors that contribute to that limit have to embed in the T2 in some way, and then they come in actually two types. You can make this mathematically precise. Some of them sit in the singularities of the T2 fibration. Okay, so the singularities of the T2 fibration are places where the dilaton axion blows up or goes to zero. So these are the D7 and O7 planes. And so these are all the things which kind of go directly down to gauge theory instantons in the D7, O7 gauge theory. So that's one class of things. But then there are also things that don't have anything to do with the singularities. They just, you take a smooth surface, you know, two complex dimensions in the base and pull it back. So you have a three complex dimensional thing in the whole thing. And they don't have any direct connection to F theory, gauge theory. They can be connected to abelian factors, to, you know, things you can see in M theory. But in any case, they're not, they're sort of the, in a way, an abelian version of this. So there is a rich story of the relation between this and three and four dimensional gauge theory. You can derive superpotentials in three dimensions basically by going to the abelian limit, turning on, so when you reduce from four to three in this amount of supersymmetry, the gauge multiple has a real adjoint scalar, just, you know, the A3 component. And by turning that on, you abelianize the problem, but then you get, what were monopoles in 3 plus 1 become instantons in 2 plus 1, and these are this type of instanton. Okay, so these do contribute to the superpotential, and there are physical effects you can see in gauge theory terms, but this analysis basically captures a different set of gauge theory effects than these. But in any case, you can just systematically now look for both types of divisors. This is a mathematical problem at this point. Okay, so now what does this arithmetic genus 1 condition mean? Well, roughly, okay, you can associate these with various modes on the instanton, and then in this case of the gauge theory, you can associate them with modes on the D7 that it's related to. The difference between the D3 and the D7 is just that the D7 extends in the non-compact dimensions. And so the negative contributions in that arithmetic genus formula are counting matter fields, the deformations of the brain, normal deformations, and the deformations of the gauge fields on the brain, and these two. And then this was the gauge, and this is the possible superpotential constraint. So basically the condition is that there has to, in some sense, be enough superpotential constraints to imagine lifting any matter that might be present. And this suggests, and Witten did also describe as a possibility, something which you can think of as the analog of four-dimensional gauge theory, Gaugino condensation. Okay, so there's a, so the literal instanton calculation of a gauge theory's superpotential in four dimensions only really works if NF is NC minus 1. Otherwise, zero modes don't tell you that the, you know, Gaugino condenses, rather than some product of Gaugino bilinear is condensed. But then the only way to make things work in the end, and then various other analyses show that you have to induce gauge Enoch condensation. So there's a sense in which a, quote, fractional instanton could be thought of as responsible. And so the symmetry argument that controls these theorems suggests that suppose this arithmetic genus were positive, I mean, so greater than one, there might be a fractional instanton of some sort that could still produce a superpotential. So there's some possibility for this. Now, in the examples that are studied in detail, you can actually reproduce all these known four-dimensional, you know, so for pure adjoint, for adjoint plus fundamentals, and this, it actually doesn't work this way. Okay, it's still chi equals one. So I'm not quite sure what the status of this is, but this is sort of the possible generalization of this analysis which exists in the literature.
But simple sort of yeah. explanation of why you wouldn't get these fractional instanton things?
Well, you don't need them in 3. You see, in 3, a fractional instanton is just a monopole within a SU2 factor. So they are fractional instantons from the higher dimensional point of view, but they still correspond to arithmetic genus 1 here.
Oh.
See, that's why I'm saying that the argument that leads you to suggest that is a little bit specious. Or I mean, you wouldn't put it that way. Wouldn't just said, well, there's some analogy. Maybe we should take this possibility into account. But if you look at the detailed analogy, it doesn't suggest that.
Wait, so
I'm saying, so basically all I'm going to use in this talk is to claim that if you wrap on the divisor of arithmetic genus 1, you get a superpotential, and then we're not going to use the more general cases, but it would be valuable to go out there and now decide, do they work or not.
But okay, so if you have something from arithmetic genus larger than 1,
right.
So what would that look like?
I'll have to really think to construct an example. So there are such examples, and we are working with, you know, to try to see, you know, if by themselves they work, if by turning on fluxes they work and so forth, but it's not something we understand. So I'm not going to...
So what is the statement without fluxes in your
thinking? Yeah, nothing is with fluxes. Now the basic statement about fluxes here is that the one I'm going to use is that if chi is 1, then I should say a little bit more strongly. Okay, so you should also make the distinction between the necessary condition chi equals 1, which relies on if these numbers are non-zero pairing on zero modes, and the strongest case is if these are all zero. Okay, and so the fluxes don't change the transformation laws and the presence of these fermion zero modes, but they might change the world volume coupling. So I think the correct statement is that if these are present and cancellations lead to this, then that could depend on fluxes. The prefactor of the instanton could depend on fluxes, but if these are not present, the prefactor will not depend on fluxes. Or, I mean, it can depend in some qualitative way, the actual number, but the fact of whether it's zero or non-zero.
And how do you know when they're not present? Is there a simple way to know that those terms are not present?
These terms. You compute them.
Compute them.
Yeah, in fact, in all the examples we talk about, these are gonna be zero. This is, in fact, part of the general analysis. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the fluxes do not affect this level of analysis, but if you went on to, you know, cases where these were non-zero, you would have to think about that. Okay. Okay, so anyhow, we're just going to look for guys with divisors wrapping arithmetic genus 1, so we know they'll work. In fact, we'll even find, as I said, satisfying the stronger condition, and we need enough such contributions. And it's interesting that you actually, in principle, don't need as many as the Kähler module. Okay, so if you look at what you're doing, you're balancing these things against the dependence in the Kähler potential. You know, if you solve dW equals 0 to get a supersymmetric ADS vacuum, you know, the dW piece clearly only depends on the Kähler moduli you put there, but then the dk piece will always depend on all of the Kähler moduli. So it's actually, the necessary condition at this point is actually a little weaker. It's that you have to have a sufficient set of divisors such that you add them up and they sit within the Kähler cone, which is something you can also work out. But again, we didn't actually use this in our considerations. It turned out we found examples with complete sets of divisors. But this is sort of the clear necessary condition, but then you still have to kind of check. And I should say that these coefficients B are not calculated in examples. What we basically did was construct examples and then check that for various order one choices of these Bs, you stabilize Kähler moduli in the large volume regime. Okay, so the claims I'm going to make later are subject to that you know, the Bs have some sort of reasonable order one values. Okay, it'll be interesting also to try to now compute these better. Okay, so now a basic consideration that you get from the mathematics of these things is that whenever you have one of these divisors of arithmetic genus 1, there's some actual holomorphic curve which intersects it negatively. Okay, and then this, again, math, I'm not going to try to explain, but in some intuitive sense, what it says is that although you would like the instanton to look like, this is assuming that the imaginary part of T is positive, you'd like it to look like x to the minus volume, there's always going to be at least one term in there that looks like x to the plus some volume or something. Okay, so that's the basic translation of this statement. It can be different for different instantons, but there's always at least one of them. And then that's the source of the argument that also was made by Robbins and Zethi, that you can't do it with one Kähler modulus, because then you have to have the term of the Bazan in that case. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's, to see this is not so easy, but then the reason why that leads to this is this. Yeah.
Again, what is the statement that you always hit on with the Bazan?
So you have a sum, okay? You have a sum of various divisors, each leading to instanton corrections, and then within each of these, there'll be, there's some linear thing in terms of the volumes of divisors. So in 2B, the natural Kähler moduli, actually volumes of, surfaces. And not curves, surfaces. And then it, in some basis, one of them will appear with a negative sign. So if you, the divisors, if a divisor is dual, if you choose a basis where one of these divisors is dual to this curve, then this guy will appear with the wrong sign. And it's just a property. See, this it's an expression of the fact that this arithmetic genus 1 condition is not so easy to accomplish. To get rid of all these moduli, to make something like an S2 or something rigid is not so easy. In fact, the mathematical statement is much stronger. It's that you can actually contract on these divisors of arithmetic genus 1. You can always find some extremal transition that contracts it down to a point. And then you can show that that implies this for some curve sitting in the divisor. And that's the key thing which they then use to list all the possibilities. Okay, but physically, this is the simplest consequence of that. And of course, it's not obviously any problem if you just have two different such contributions, and there's one minus sign someplace in one and a different minus sign someplace in another. It's not any obvious problem. And then in our examples, we find, no, it's not a problem. You can find examples. So you just have to go on to more than one Kähler modulus. Okay, so now it's a hard problem, but fortunately one which was essentially solved in a large, interesting class of examples, which are the elliptic vibrations over a Fano threefold base. Okay, and again, probably not worth going into great detail about that, but these are classified, and there's about 100 of them. And 18 of them are toric. They're actual toric varieties in three dimensions that you can write these, toric data for. And then out of the, the math that classified this used essentially these arithmetic, genus 1 divisors. So it wasn't infinitely difficult for Grassi to do this classification, but obviously a fair amount of work, and it's fortunate that she did it. And anyhow, within these 18 toric Fano threefold bases, six of them should work. And we looked at two. Six of them have this complete set of divisors, and we looked at two and made the check that I said, that if you assume order one instanton coefficients, they do stabilize moduli often in the large volume regime. And you have to actually check what is the large volume regime. So the hard part is not to calculate these things because they're in the list. The hard part is that you then have to say what values of moduli actually do correspond to metrics. There's some cone and various inequalities that they have to satisfy. And so you have to work that out. And it's not that hard because these examples all have few, up to 10. You can show that, just from the list, they have up to 10 Kähler moduli. We're talking about the Kähler size. So one of our examples had 5, another one had 3. And it's not that hard to work out this cone, but you have to do that to check that it's indeed stabilizing in the large volume regime. So fortunately, Bogdan is a great expert in this sort of thing, and he did that. So the simplest of these models in terms of number of complex structure moduli was based on a Fano called F18, has 89 complex structure moduli. Okay, now, I'll talk a bit later about counting flux vacua, and according to the type of lower bound that I got with Sujay Eshok, which I spoke about here in October, putting in the tadpole number, which is chi over 24 of the fourfold, the number that comes out is about 10 to the 307. Okay, so it's one of these things that you think, at least according to your present understanding, has vast numbers of flux vacua. And then the results I'll talk about tell you that at weak string coupling, they're uniformly distributed in GS squared, and I think that's supposed to be GS, actually. It's GS squared. It really is. It's the d-tau over tau squared distribution. So, No, it's GS. I think this is a mistake. In any case, you know, there are lots of different weak coupling. If you want the coupling GS to be less than 1/100, you cut the number down by 1/100, and then much more importantly, as emphasized in KKLT, again something I've talked about previously, to control the Kähler stabilization, you need this extra constant term into potential, which has to be small. Okay, not ridiculously small, you know, like 10 to the 10, minus 10 will certainly do it. But then you can show on very general grounds, and I'll produce much more gory explicit results than this, that the value of this number is uniformly distributed near zero for these flux vacua. So again, if you want this to be less than 10 to minus 10, that cuts the number by 10 to minus 10.
Wait, yeah. W is complex, so is it W or W?
Absolute W.
Is that just W is the density?
Yeah.
So it's not a universal solution of the complex W plane.
Yeah, that's right. It says absolute W. Yeah, it's a little, that's right. So the, yeah, now definitely there's not a zero coming in. You know, it comes into a finite value. Yeah. So that's because W is linear in the flux. You know, it's basically to say, you know, this intuitive argument is right, to say that here's the sphere of fluxes, as in your argument with Raphael. W picks out a direction. And then just, you know, split it into real and imaginary parts. That picks out a direction, you know, in itself, in this real flux space. Now you're just projecting down to the... So that's not a major cut either. Now you can worry about this geometrical factor. And I've made some progress. I found the mathematician who actually knows in principle how to compute these things, named Jixin Liu at Irvine. And So I'll mention a little bit of this later, but basically the geometric factor is going to be much, much bigger than 10 to the minus 307, as you might imagine. So that's not going to cut the number either. Okay, so anyhow, there's good evidence that there are enough flux vacua to accomplish this. Okay, so then that was the models with this toric Fano base, and those are kind of the most tractable. And then there are other Fano bases. The mathematicians classified all these Fano threefolds, and the others are just a little bit harder to work with. And as I say, out of this, about 100, 23 of the non, if I'm remembering correctly, I didn't put it here, but I think 23 of the non-toric and the 6 of the toric work. So about a third of the models actually work. So it depends how you say the word generic. By most standards, this would be pretty generic. In some technical standard, it's not, because, you know, if you pick a model, it probably won't work. But it's not that hard to find models that work. So then there's another class of model. These are, as I say, you know, although the number of complex structure moduli is maybe not the worst thing. You know, so the amount of symmetry that the theories have, you know, which is perhaps the measure of how complicated they are, and all these guys are pretty complicated by that standard too, these toric diagrams, you know, over, you know, like, you know, 10 by 10 matrices and things. And it takes a fair amount of work to compute anything. And there are, we think that if you do implement, in particular fluxes fixing matter on brains, that there are simple models that have heterotic duals. So one that we made some distance on is the Calabi-Yau elliptic vibration over P2. And so this is a very standard studied guy. And we actually think that will work. It has a heterotic dual. It just requires having, you know, lifting part of the matter. And in the heterotic language, you get one unbroken E8 or E6 or something, and then on the with no matter, and then on the other side you get some number of adjoints that you then would have to argue get stabilized by flux, because you need two moduli to work in that model. You know, two instantons to fix the two Kähler classes of the base and the P1 fiber. And you can find cases where, again, the divisors exist with the arithmetic genus 1, just that these numbers age, you know, are non-zero. So there is matter in that gauge theory, and you have to argue that something gets rid of it. And we didn't get quite that far.
So, Mike, in this one example, do all these 10 to 307 vacua have the same gauge group and same number of families, but will have different mass matrices and so on?
Let's see. Okay, so these are just turning on threefold fluxes. So I think I would say yes. I mean, the I think the gauge groups are all generically going to be U1s. You know, this guy doesn't have any. And so then, of course, it gets Seidel to, you know, decide if U1s get eaten by some anomaly cancellation and so forth. And that might interact with this. You know, but basically, you know, they all have some large number of U1s.
Is there a reason why you don't get random variables?
Just the simplicity of that. Again, we chose something with no singularity, a totally smooth threefold and fourfold. Yeah. You could tune, of course, moduli. Probably fluxes could fix you to points with enhanced gauge symmetry. But the generic point will just have U1s. Okay. Okay, so then KKLT, of course, you know, proceed to say, you know, just you do that, you know, takes them a page, and then you add an anti-brain, and you know, here's your de Sitter space, and you know, we believe it too, but you know, if you try to actually do it, this is as far as we got, and then you also have to grant that there are many more moduli to stabilize because there are all these brain and bundle moduli on the brains, and they were all lurking there in the background. And then the we might now that I think about it, we might be able to get farther in this one because you can understand. I mean, there are these brain moduli. These are the things that you would want to start turning on fourfold fluxes to fix. So the sort of generic statement would be that if you allow yourself to turn on all the fourfold fluxes, you might think you could fix those. But the argument that we give in the paper for not talking about these things is once you know that the things really are brain and bundle moduli, they all parameterize compact spaces. Okay, so obviously, yeah.
Why do you have these things you don't modify the original modified space at the top? There's some sort of hierarchical division of the moduli space.
Okay.
Ones that you have for the, let's say, clustering moduli and the open string moduli.
Well, that's not the significant one. The significant difference is between things which are non-compact and can run away and things which parameterize compact spaces.
Well, what I was thinking is that this is compact only because it's fibered over.
Yeah, because you fixed the, because right, what you want to justify is you want a separation of scales. You want to argue that the clustering moduli got fixed at a higher scale. And then basically the simplest thing to claim is that putting in this anti-D3 band is going to induce this incredibly tiny low scale potential, far below the things you were talking about before. And you'll get fields of very, very tiny masses, but they will be stabilized.
Yeah, but you have a W in all the places.
No, I don't. I think this is a correct argument if all you ask is that you give mass to these fields. Now, if you want the mass to be more than 10 to the minus 20 eV or something, you know, if you break supersymmetry over here and you're talking about the mass of some mode over here, it might give it some incredibly tiny mass. And now you might ask, can you give them all a reasonable mass? And that's the point where trying to maintain the separation of scales might make it difficult. So I don't think there's a question of principle, but anyhow, if we phrase the problem as to find a guy with stabilized moduli, I think once you argue that the remaining moduli live in compact moduli spaces, which seems clear to us, again, I can discuss in great detail in examples if you like, then generic potentials will stabilize them. And one might even go farther by thinking carefully about what these fourfold fluxes do, and then showing that you can really stabilize all moduli in these abelian sorts of examples. Okay, so I guess that's all I'm going to say about that. Now, I guess I don't know how much time you're going to give me. I have a number of, it's 125. I have various interesting results about flux vacua that came out of work with Frederick Deneff. Let me maybe give a brief survey of this.
We don't really think about breaking and continuing because some of them are here every detail.
Yeah.
Probably don't.
Okay, fair enough.
It is a good point.
Well, I can skip ahead to the conclusions and then we can come back. So.
At 3:30.
Yeah. Okay, so anyhow, the.
Sorry, at 3:30.
Yeah, we're not going to take that long.
Yeah, so we can squeeze in another.
Okay, so my previous talks, you know, these statistical ideas were just ideas on things to work on, and obviously it depends on having, you know, being able to work with such vacua that stabilize moduli and do the other things you want and finding their distributions. And, you know, we make vacua now. I'm going to, in the second part of the talk, talk about various interesting properties of the distribution of flux vacua. So it turns out that there's an enhancement of the number of vacua near conical points. So we've studied one complex modulus examples in great detail. And you find, for example, so these are points which have a dual gauge theory interpretation, and they generate a hierarchically small scale. And you find things like the number of vacua of which this scale is 10 to the minus 10 or less on the miroquintic is 1% of the total number of vacua. It's not 10 to the minus 10 of the total number. And that's basically making precise the statement that, yes, it's not that hard to generate these throats and these logarithmic hierarchies, but actually doing the counting through the choices of fluxes and see that, yes, those are not the majority of vacua, you know, 1% under the criteria I put in, but still, you know, very, very much enhanced compared to the 10 to the minus 10 number, say. On the other hand, in this example, it turns out to be inconsistent with mass stability. All these vacua, if you grant now that you start with supersymmetric ADS and lift by other effects, okay, then you look for tachyons of this supersymmetric part of the potential, and they all have tachyons for a simple reason, which I'll explain. So there's a lot of structure in here. We think that has to do with special features of this one modulus case, but that's as far as we got. There are interesting correlations with cosmological constant. There's a very general fall-off in numbers of vacua, large complex structure, and if you allow mirror symmetry into discussion, large volume. Okay, so that's one reason we didn't actually find flux vacua in this 89-parameter case. We did work out in great detail the large complex structure limit of the prepotential. We could find all such flux vacua. We can show to a pretty convincing argument that there are not any. And that's a generic feature of these things. It just falls off as a huge power in neural language of the volume for very simple reasons that I'll explain. So this is like a preview. The general thing that you get when you look at supersymmetry breaking, again, you know, we did one parameter cases to make any general statements of something of an extrapolation, but you start to get uniform distributions of these supersymmetry breaking scales. And basically the claim I made before that minus 3W squared is uniformly distributed, that's the guy that cancels the cosmological constant. So to the extent that that's uniformly distributed, the condition of canceling the cosmological constant is neutral regarding the supersymmetry breaking scale. You know, whatever supersymmetry breaking scale you pick, there's this, you know, uniform distribution of vacua that could have canceled its cosmological constant. And so that's one thing that favors high scale. Again, at this very, very early stage of the calculations, if you have many supersymmetry breaking parameters, you know, multidimensional space, many F terms, many D terms, then it's just the distance from the origin, and then that heavily favors high scale. So it could easily happen, we didn't get that far, that high scale breaking comes out to be preferred. In fact, if I just had to guess based on this tiny information, that's what I would say, based on this, you know, very, very oversimplified analysis. Now, whether this is talking about high scale breaking in the visible sector that we hope to see at OHC, well, obviously, everything I talked about is basically all sectors of the theory. You know, almost all sectors are probably hidden sectors. So this is not literally that statement, but I think if you had some general knowledge of the distribution of hidden sectors and so forth, you could then turn this into such a statement. So I think, you know, not a proof, but some sort of, you know, educated guess about the likely scale of supersymmetry breaking is not impossible in such a framework. Okay, so another use of these statistics is to use them as tests of duality in kind of an obvious way once we get statistics for two dual sets of constructions. Finally, I avoided talking a lot about numbers. You saw this 10 to the 307, and, you know, again, the formulas we have now can easily predict much bigger numbers coming out of F theory. I think we have to hope to avoid this kind of radical loss of predictivity that I've talked about in other talks, that there are instabilities or other inconsistencies that just take out major classes of these vacua. Now, whether the precise type of calculations I'm talking about have value depend on, well, first of all, are these, you know, subsequent consideration, hypothetical things that throw out lots of these vacua decorrelated with the things I just talked about? Well, then, good. You know, we can use the same distributions, and the numbers come out to be small. And that's the very optimistic scenario. If they're correlated in a way we can take into account in a better calculation, well, that's good, too. We have to do more work, but that's the optimistic thing. And, of course, if you can't understand this, then you can't say anything. But I don't think, you know, again, the high number from almost any point of view is bad, except maybe the anthropic point of view, I don't know. But from a pure string theory point of view, the high number is bad. And on the other hand, it's much too early to know what numbers will come out at the end. And if such, you know, various possibilities I listed in the beginning lower the number of vacua to the point where interesting regimes of parameter space have an expected number of fewer than one vacuum, you know, significantly fewer than one, coming out of such approximate calculations, then you could claim to make a real prediction from string theory. You know, it might turn out to be false because of fine tunings you didn't see, but that would be grounds for a prediction better than anything we can do right now. So that's why the absolute number of vacu, I think, is important to study. Okay, so those were the conclusions, and I'll come back to the flux part after a break.